It is 8:07 in the Twin Cities, 21 degrees. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. And very happy to welcome, I guess, the now retired professor, Stephen Scheer from Carleton College. Although you'd never know he was retired because I get all of this data that he sends. He also sent me today who voted how in 2018 in five different charts. Fascinating stuff, Professor Stephen Scheer. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, I'm glad to know that you're a happy recipient.
Oh, I am. I mean, there's so much, you know, when you look at what happened on Tuesday night, let me just ask you, from where you sit, and I know because you're somebody who really has studied the history of these presidencies and American politics, what was the biggest surprise to you?
Well, I think the biggest news out of the election is how the suburbs voted, both in Minnesota and nationally. And what you're seeing is the fraying of the Republican coalition. You know, Trump appeals to rural, lower-income, white, older voters, and high-income Republicans in the suburbs are not too keen on the Trump GOP, and I think we saw that certainly in the Twin Cities suburbs.
Right.
Then we saw it in a bunch of other suburban areas in the country.
Well, and that's definitely something that you pointed out in that data that you showed me, mm-hmm. is that 18 to 29-year-old voters chose Democratic candidates over Republicans 2-1.
Yep.
Is that something that is different if you go back 20 years, or do people who are 18 to 29, once they vote Democratic or once they vote Republican, are they pretty much set in their ways for the rest of their lives?
Well, that can be the case. For example, we know people who grew up during the Depression were lifelong Democrats, you know, growing up in the 1930s. We also know there was a Reagan youth generation in the 1980s. So it's quite possible that we're getting a new millennial group of voters who will be inclined towards Democratic voting for the long term. We won't know, obviously, until the future transpires, but it's certainly plausible.
All right. Well, let's take a look at, because there was so much focus, you know, on these congressional seats in Minnesota, mm-hmm. and there were four that were considered, you know, from the onset as toss-ups. And well, yes, they were, because they all got tossed up and they came down differently. what we saw is that we had two open seats, which is actually a rarity. I mean, Minnesota only has eight congressional seats, but we had two open seats. The 8th congressional district, which had been held by Congressman Rick Nolan, who retired, obviously a Democrat. And then you had the 1st congressional district, which had been held by Congressman Tim Walz, who obviously gave up his seat to run for governor of Minnesota. That worked out well for him.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll get to that in a bit. But those two seats had been held by Democrats. I might say, though, extremely narrowly. I think Rick Nolan and Tim Walz, I think, each won their seats in 2016 by perhaps
about 1%.
Yeah, 2,000 or so votes. I mean, yeah. not a lot.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on those? Because they certainly fit into the pattern that you said, but that was – and then the two suburban districts, the 3rd and the 2nd, that were held by Congressman Paulson, who'd been in office for a number of years.
Yeah, 10 years.
10 years, which is a long time, had gotten some seniority. And obviously Congressman Lewis, who'd only been in there for one term, they both got ousted. So the net gain of looking at Minnesota, and there was all this talk about Minnesota, you know, and getting a net gain for Republicans or net gain for Democrats, it was the same amount, basically. We still have 3 Republican members of Congress, and we still have and I'm sorry, I think we lost Professor Scheer here.
I'm here.
Oh, you are? Okay, I'm so sorry.
I don't know where that came from, Esme,
okay.
But it's gone now.
But I guess, you know, at the end of the day, Minnesota, of our 8 districts, we still have 3 Republicans, and we still have
5
Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But it's changed.
Yeah. Well, what I think we saw on election night is what I call a regional realignment. That is, the suburbs have clearly moved in a Democratic direction, and that may be a long-term trend. But Greater Minnesota is becoming more uniformly Republican, and there's a third point about that to make. If you look at the 7th District, which is, along with the 6th District, one of the two most conservative U.S. House districts in the state, Colin Peterson, the longtime Democrat there, running against an opponent who had no money, won by only 4%. That, you know, that district is definitely trending in a Republican direction. Trump carried it by 31%.
Right. Right.
And so it's just a matter of time before that area, I think, becomes Republican. But I think the problem for the GOP in the state is that there are more people in the metro and the suburbs than there are in Greater Minnesota. The growth area in terms of population is a Democratic area, and that's a real problem for the Republican Party in this state.
Well, and also I think that they have to be concerned about the age gap, because let's face it, we're all getting older.
Mm-hmm.
And to have, you know, what your breakdown showing really this overwhelming trend for younger people who are under the age of 29 voting for Democrats has got to be a source of concern.
Right. And, you know, Politico website's done a good analysis of the Minnesota elections. And what they've done is study the county results. And what they found is that there's a strong relationship that older counties vote Republican in Minnesota and younger counties vote Democratic, which is in support of your point.
Right. In terms, though, of you know, the Republicans, yes, they did flip two seats, but they also lost two seats. And then yet again, it really is remarkable to me in a state that's so divided that once again, you didn't have anybody who was a Republican winning a statewide office.
Yeah, well, we haven't had Republicans win a statewide office since 2006. That's quite a while.
And the last one was Governor Pawlenty.
Right, and that was a very narrow win by about 20,000 votes statewide. So, you know, it's interesting. The Republican Party really has to make some major adjustments here. Essentially, they tried to do the same thing twice in the governor's race. That is, run the same candidate 4 years later. Well, you know, Jeff Johnson lost by 5 points 4 years ago, and now he loses by 12 points. So one would think the party would learn that repeating itself in the way it has since 2006 is a statewide loser.
Right. And that's, you know, but what's so interesting, Professor Scheer, is that I thought it was so interesting that you know, yes, Jeff Johnson was the nominee again. Yes, he lost. And you're absolutely right. He lost by 5 points 4 years ago, and he lost by double digits this time. But he took it to somebody. He crushed Governor Tim Pawlenty. And when he was down in, you know, the polls, granted, there weren't a lot of polls here, but one poll showed him down by double digits to Governor Pawlenty. And I was at Governor Pawlenty's headquarters in August for the primary.
Yeah.
And I don't think his people saw it coming.
No, they didn't see it coming. But I also am not certain that Tim Pawlenty was the solution to their problem, because, in fact, Charlie Weaver, who was chief of staff for Tim Pawlenty, said as much in the Star Tribune today that the problems of the Republican Party in the state were so big this year that it's not clear Tim Pawlenty could have fared that much better in the governor's race than Jeff Johnson. So they've got some deep-seated problems here, Esme.
All right. We were chatting with Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College. We're going to take a quick break. I do want to kind of continue this theme, because the enthusiasm and the passion for President Trump amongst his supporters here in Minnesota and across the country is so strong and so intense. And yet there does seem to be this gap and this problem. And how big of a problem is it as we march on to obviously the inevitable, which is 2020? So keep it right here. News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 8:20 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor Stephen Scheer. You know, we were talking about your analysis of the elections and how much trouble you feel Republicans are in terms of their ability and their failure to be able to grab a statewide office once again, not since 2006, 12 years ago, since Governor Pawlenty was reelected as a Republican in the state of Minnesota, gotten a statewide office. You know, one of the things that is so striking is, you know, I've gone to some of these rallies that the president has held here in Minnesota, and they're really extraordinary events. The passion, the intensity, the enthusiasm for the president amongst his supporters is something that is really pretty amazing. And yet, you're signaling that you think there are vulnerabilities here, and that he's kind of working himself perhaps into a corner by not expanding his base.
Yeah, I think, you know, he is, I've been wondering when he would try and do this. There's a certain discontinuity or peculiarity about the Trump presidency. If you actually look at his policies, he's actually sort of center-right. He could, I think, broaden his appeal with a different personality, perhaps, because he's very polarizing, and he excites people in great number, but he also alienates people in great number. And I think what we saw in the Twin City suburbs and in suburban regions throughout the country is a lot of highly educated, high-income people find Trump personally so unpleasant that it's starting to hurt his party.
But yet, you know, they picked up Senate seats.
Yeah.
And a lot of places that he went and campaigned for candidates, those candidates won.
Yeah.
Including here in Minnesota. I mean, Pete Stauber, and maybe that was, you know, right, an exception, but certainly in the first congressional district, Jim Hagedorn picking up a victory, a very narrow victory. And you have to wonder if the president had not come to the first congressional district, if Mr. Hagedorn would have won.
That's a really good point. But your examples, I think, show that what Trump does is go to the conservative states in America and excite the base there. And he was able to remove Democratic senators who are from relatively conservative states. Here's the real problem for the president going into the 2020 election. He carried Pennsylvania, he carried Michigan, he carried Wisconsin. These were key states that gave him the Electoral College victory.
By not a lot of votes.
Yeah, but if you look at how those states voted this week, they did not vote for Republicans in statewide office. Scott Walker is out. Democrats gained the governorship of Michigan. A Democratic senator was reelected in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And a Democratic governor was reelected in Pennsylvania. Democrats gained a bunch of U.S. House seats in Pennsylvania. I mean, the evidence is there, Esme, that it's going to be tough for him to carry those three states again.
And that's, I mean, that's because I think people look at the 2016 election and they may not realize that it really was. Obviously, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote by 2 million votes.
Yeah.
But it was, I think, what was it, 180,000? It was not a lot of votes.
Yeah.
If that.
If you change about 77,000 votes in those three states, Hillary is president. Yeah.
Well,
so you see how close it was.
Right. Well, since you mentioned Scott Walker, I know that this was, Governor Walker certainly had a target on his back, not just in Wisconsin, but I think nationally. I think a lot of Democrats really wanted to get him because he's somebody who has really been a lightning rod on many Democratic causes, especially, you know, pro-labor causes. What was it in the end? Was it just Scott Walker fatigue?
Well, yeah, I think Walker, although he has a very different personality than Trump, I think in some ways he governed like Trump in that he was, sort of governing in a very polarizing manner. You know, I mean, it's not often you get a recall election for a sitting governor in a state like Wisconsin, and that's what he had to survive. And I think what happens is that gradually you get your opponent so energized and they amass so many resources that they can take you out. See, I think Trump Trump
and, Tony Evers was, you know, with all due respect to Mr. Evers, he's not sort of a ball of fire. This is not the most, you know, he's a pretty understated guy. He's not, you know, somebody who's wildly charismatic at all.
No.
In fact, he's the complete opposite of that.
Well, but in some ways, people were voting for a contrast because Walker's such a lightning rod. And if Democrats are smart in 2020, they'll nominate somebody with a personality like Tony Evers, who will be quite a contrast to Donald Trump. But the point I wanted to make is that Trump in 2016, I think, really snuck up on people. Nobody really took him seriously. They really didn't think he could win. He was behind in the polls all the time. And then all of a sudden on Election Day, big surprise. Well, that can't happen in 2020. Everybody knows who Trump is.
That's a really interesting point.
Right. And he has really mobilized a lot of people for him and against him. And he won't catch anybody by surprise again. And I think that's a problem for Trump, in that his opponents have put a target on his back like they put a target on Scott Walker's back. They're mobilizing, and I think they had a significant success in the U.S. House races and in some states this midterm, and I'm sure they'll be gunning for him in 2020. So it's going to be a tough road for the president.
You know, that's, and Professor Stephen Scheer raises, I think that's a really actually fascinating point, that a lot of people who voted for President Trump perhaps didn't think he was going to win. I mean, they wanted him to win. They supported him. But you're right. He was the surprise factor. And it kind of reminds me, in a way, of the Jesse Ventura vote in 1998, where people just really didn't think he could win, but they were mad and they wanted something. They wanted to send a message that outsiders can matter and that a different voice can matter. And I think that probably was it. And I think what you're saying is that that kind of a vote can't happen anymore because everybody does know him.
Yeah, and well, look what happened to Jesse Ventura. I mean, he surprised everybody and won.
He shocked the world.
And then he governed, and people started to line up against him, and his popularity dropped, and he ended up not running for a second term.
Right. Although, with the president, you know, there was the extraordinary news conference that was extraordinary for many, many reasons.
But
one of the things I thought was so interesting is the president kind of ticked down the list of Republicans, and he did name Congressman Eric Paulson of Minnesota as he didn't want the embrace. I think that was the phrase. That it was the Republicans who tried to not stand in line and you know, salute and absolutely get behind the president 100%, that those Republicans didn't fare well. And that's why you see people like Lindsey Graham going, you know, doing a 180 and getting completely behind the president that he absolutely vilified for so long.
Yeah, well, South Carolina is different than the 3rd District of Minnesota.
True.
And in South, you know, that's one of the, if not the most conservative state in America, one of the 3 or 4 most conservative states. And Trump certainly has a popularity there that he doesn't have in the Twin Cities suburbs, you know.
Right. All right. Well, listen, we do have to take a break because we have to give you some weather, which is very important for everyone across the state. But when we come back, I'd like to break down some of the key races here in Minnesota, including that very controversial attorney general's race, obviously the race for governor. You have the 2 U.S. Senate seats and some of those congressional races with Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College. You're listening to News Radio 830. It is 8:34 in the Twin Cities. I want to invite you to tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. Live in studio, we will have obviously all the latest news and weather with Micah Gesnack, but live in studio at 10:30 a.m., the governor-elect of Minnesota, Congressman Tim Walz, will be a live guest, and also the chair of the Minnesota Republican Party, Jennifer Carnahan. Right now, we're chatting with Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College, talking about a breakdown of the election on Tuesday. Let me ask you about the governor's race. Certainly, Tim Walz led in every single poll. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be a very decisive win.
Yeah, it did. 53, I'm looking at the numbers right here, 53.9% to 42.4%. Never behind in a poll, and of course the Democratic formula this year was to increase their outstate appeal with a candidate like Walz, who had represented the first district in southern Minnesota for several terms. And he managed to do that. He carried a bunch of counties in the southeastern corner of the state, including
his old district,
Rochester, and he carried more of those than did Tina Smith, who also won a comfortable election. But the outstate voting for Walz, I think, really sort of bumped up his margin. And he's in an electorally strong position, I have to say, starting his first term.
Right. And that was, I mean, that big a win, I think, is something that I think does stand out. And certainly it was, it exceeded the biggest margins in the polls. I mean,
yeah it did. I know the last KSTP poll that was published about 5 days before the election had the race at about 8 points, and nobody had double digits in their polls. And so he actually exceeded his poll margin. That just reflects also the fact that the Democrats had superior resources to the Republicans in terms of money and get out the vote effort. And I tell you, the Republicans have a lot of catching up to do.
Right. And he also is just, you know, I mean, I've covered a lot of people in terms of campaign stops. I mean, this is a very polished speaker. I mean, he's somebody who does well sort of in the one-on-ones in terms of delivering the speeches. He had a message that it's like he was closing this race. You know, he was sounding this unity theme even weeks ago.
Right, and that unity theme was a very smart theme, because I think if you think about it, he was making an implicit argument against the president and the president's style, and the president's style really does grate on a lot of people. And he was saying, he was essentially presenting himself as an alternative approach to politics. One Minnesota will work together. I'm not going to be, polarizing and stigmatizing people.
Right. And I think it's something that he sounded not just in the final week, which I think a number of people tried to make that pivot, but he did that, you know, earlier on.
Yeah.
And I think obviously in a very convincing fashion. Let's talk about the Minnesota Attorney General's race, because this one was just a race that was so volatile, and yet Congressman Ellison pulled it out.
Yeah. Well, he did with only about a 4-point margin, which was significantly smaller than you found for Klobuchar or Smith or Walz. And I think that what the polling showed throughout the fall is that Ellison started in a weak position when all the charges of domestic abuse were out there. But as the election got closer and more negative information and advertising about Doug Wardlow came out, he was able to actually move up in the polls and benefited, I think, tremendously by the very large turnout in the metro area, particularly Hennepin County, his home district. You know, their turnout was 77%, which is higher than the statewide presidential turnout.
Wow. I had not heard that.
So turnout
in Hennepin was 77?
77. And statewide, it was about 64%.
Wow.
Which
okay.
is usually about, usually our turnout in midterms is about 50%, and presidentially it's 75%. So we had 64% statewide and 77% in a midterm in Hennepin. And that simply reflects the fact that Democrats do a very good job of getting out urban voters.
Right. And which is in contrast, actually, though, to 4 years ago.
Yes.
Where the Democratic vote was basically suppressed. There were a lot fewer Democrats that came out in 2016 in the metro area.
Right. And I think for two reasons. First, many of them found Hillary Clinton to be an uninspiring candidate. And secondly, a lot of them thought, well, Trump can't win. He's been behind in the polls and he's a very controversial figure.
Right.
Well, both those things will be gone in 2020, you see.
Right. I do think, I think that there were a lot of things. I think you raise a really good point, because I think that Congressman Ellison ran this race as if he was way ahead.
Yeah.
You know, without really talking about Mr. Wardlow's record and the positions he had advocated for, the work he had done for the Alliance Defending Freedom,
mm-hmm.
and really just didn't get into that at all until a couple of weeks before the election. I also think that the release of the divorce records, Congressman Ellison's divorce records from his wife, mm-hmm. Kim,
yeah.
who he'd been married to for 25 years, I think helped him because it
didn't show any issue.
It didn't show you they've been married in a pretty yeah. tumultuous marriage. She admit, you know, acknowledged that she had suffered from mental illness and was deeply troubled for some of that. I mean, I think that helped him. And then I also think that Wardlow's comments that he was going to fire all 42
yeah.
Democrats in the Minnesota Attorney General's. I mean, people were kind of going, what, you know, these are attorneys. They're working on consumer issues. It's not supposed to be a partisan place.
Yeah,
and I think that really hurt him.
That was a big unforced error, you know. And he really couldn't afford any unforced errors in running in a year like this when Democrats were trending in such a positive direction.
Right, but 77%. Wow, that's I had not actually heard that.
That explains a lot about what happened in the state.
Yeah. Right. It certainly does. Obviously, Senator Klobuchar once again pulling in enormous numbers, which is, I think, a credit to her that
yeah.
in this state that is divided, even though, you know, Republicans are having trouble getting statewide offices. I mean, pulling in these kinds of numbers is quite a feat.
Yeah, well, of course, Jim Neuberger had no money and ran his campaign out of his basement. So when you face an opponent like that, you can run up good numbers. But she is genuinely popular and can probably be a U.S. senator as long as she wants to be.
And that's a question.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Will she run for president or not? It's quite possible we'll have as many as 20 presidential candidates running for the Democratic nomination in 2020. And if there are 20, I wouldn't doubt that she'd be one of those 20.
And when do they have to make up their mind?
Oh, well, some of them have already made up their mind.
Right.
And are just timing it.
Well, when's the latest you really can?
I think you have to, I would say by the middle of next year, frankly, by June of next year would be the absolute latest, because everything starts up. You know, the fundraising is such an arduous thing, and you have to campaign in 50 states, and you have to develop campaign infrastructure in a whole bunch of states, and that takes months and months and months.
The other, obviously, U.S. Senate race, Senator Tina Smith, that race looked like it was going to be a lot closer, and it turned out not to be that close.
That's right. Two things that I think really disadvantaged both Johnson and Housley, Johnson the governor candidate and Housley the Senate candidate, the GOP, they didn't have resources. They were greatly outspent by independent groups and by the incumbents. So if you're a challenger to a better known incumbent, you've got to either match or exceed their resources, and neither Johnson nor Housley came close to that.
Right. And I did talk to a supporter of State Senator Karn Housley, who did kind of bemoan the fact that the National Republican Senatorial Committees did not pump money into Minnesota. And they,
yeah.
they pointed to that. And they didn't. But I guess it was a sort of a situation with, you know, there's a certain amount of resources, and you wonder at what point was that game plan drawn up? Was it drawn up before even Al Franken resigned?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that, you know, she ended up losing by 11 points. So it's hard to see how additional resources could have reversed that, because as we see in the state, it was a Democratic year. I mean, this was a blue wave in Minnesota. I don't think you can generalize that to the country as a whole, because you have, you know, results that vary from region to region. But in Minnesota, there was definitely a blue wave, and I can understand why the National Republican Senatorial Committee did not put Minnesota on its priority list. They had a lot of other inviting targets, some of which were successful for them.
Right, and it's again, it's kind of the just, you know, how many resources you have, and You just have a finite number of resources or amount of resources that you can plow in.
Exactly.
We have to take a quick break, but I want to talk about some of these congressional races and then also the fact that the Minnesota House, all 140, I always forget how many members there are, 143, is it? Anyway, it's a lot.
Yeah, 134.
134, there you go. That did flip after some promises from some gun control groups, pro-gun control groups said that they were going to flip that. I want to ask Professor Scheer about that. So keep it right here, folks. We're going to take a quick break. More with Stephen Scheer after this on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 8:49 in the Twin Cities. Some closing thoughts with Esme Murphy and Professor Stephen Scheer. I do want to ask your thoughts about the third congressional district race in which Dean Phillips really won a decisive victory over incumbent Congressman Eric Paulson, somebody who had been in office for more than a decade. What do you think made the difference here? Was it the suburban voters? Was it the difficulty that Congressman Paulson had of trying to be with and yet not with President Trump?
Yeah.
Or was it also what I thought was a remarkably clever campaign and just sort of almost an artful campaign by Dean Phillips that was funny, inclusive? I just thought it was very well done, very original in a lot of the campaign themes they sounded in terms of their commercials. Really, I think one that I think people could study if they want to look at a campaign that was successful in terms of unseating a well-established incumbent.
Well, yeah, I think Phillips adopted some of Paul Wellstone's old tactics.
Yeah.
Drove around in an old truck, had an open collar campaign, everybody's invited, populist man of the people, that sort of thing. The key thing for the third district is it's a highly educated district. It is the most highly educated congressional district in the state. 49% of the adults in that district have college degrees, by far the largest of any congressional district. One thing that has really happened as part of our realignment in this state is that if your congressional district is above the state average in number of college degrees, you're represented by a Democrat. If your congressional district is below the state average in the number of college degrees, you are now represented by a Republican.
Wow.
And this is one example of that. Highly educated suburban voters really rejected the GOP in a big way throughout the suburbs this time.
All right. Well, that is interesting, and it's as if the district moved on.
Yeah. Well, and you remember Hillary Clinton carried the third district by 9.5%, so it was trending Democratic in any event, and tremendous resources were brought to bear on Phillips' behalf. I think he lent himself $1.5 million along the way,
right,
which it's nice to be able to do. I wish I could do that. But,
right. But he was also, I do have to say, he was out there. I mean, I remember going to the Edina parade.
Everyone's invited.
July 4th of 2017, and there was Dean Phillips with 40 volunteers, and Congressman Paulson was not there.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was showing up counts.
Showing up counts, and Paulson didn't quite know what to do about Trump, and there wasn't much he could do about Trump because Trump really alienated a lot of voters in that district, and Paulson couldn't overcome that.
And I think sometimes his response to it was somewhat tortured.
Yeah.
Very difficult, I think, to have it both ways when it comes to the president.
Right. Now, the president said that Paulson lost because he didn't embrace the president, and I'd like to see the evidence for that proposition.
Well, in that district, That would have, you know, he might have lost by even more. But
yeah.
Let me ask you about the Minnesota House flipping. I mean, you had a number of groups, and there was one group in particular, Minnesota Moms Demand Action. I've done a few stories on. Were they specifically targeted House members that they felt were vulnerable and specifically targeted them on the gun issue?
Mm-hmm.
And they said there will be – and I was here when former Mayor Bloomberg of New York, who has funded you know, pro-gun control groups to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, you know, that he held a rally with them. And this group got up and said, you know something? We've been working on this for – you know, well over a year. We're targeting these state representatives that don't support gun control measures, and there will be a reckoning. They will pay, and we're going to vote them out. And to a certain extent, they did.
Yeah, well, you have to keep in mind that a group like that, plus the Democratic Party, plus other groups, were all moving in the same direction. So the turnout in the suburbs, for example, was beyond what the Democratic Party itself, with its own efforts, was projecting. Roz Peterson in Lakeville, the assistant majority leader of the state house, received more votes this time than she did 2 years ago, yet lost the election.
Wow.
So that tells you something. Having said that, though, Esme, here's something I think everybody has to keep in mind. Since 1952, the party, the sitting president, has lost an average
right.
of 17 Minnesota House seats. This year it was 18. So, you know, there are sort of rhythms in Minnesota politics, and this was part of that, I think.
Right. And there are you're absolutely right. And in terms of, you know, nationally, in terms of, you know, control of the House or control of the mm-hmm. Congress. But as you look ahead, as you consider those rhythms nationally, what are some of the things that jump out at you?
Well, in order for the Republican Party to enjoy a positive rhythm, they've got to become a more effective electoral force. Right now, they are outspent and outorganized. They have problems finding candidates who appeal beyond their relatively narrow partisan voice. A base. Those are three big problems right there. And so when you are at a competitive disadvantage like that, it's hard to make any rhythm work for you. And I think that is the main conundrum facing the state in the future. Do we have a fully competitive Republican Party in this state?
Right. But and Trump going forward, though.
Yeah, well, I think we can see that Trump is not going to be very helpful in the metro area. As I mentioned earlier, he is now a known quantity. He can't surprise people. People take him who oppose him, take him as a serious threat, and they mobilize intensely against him. And that was the story in Minnesota this year.
Right. Because and obviously the Democrats, though, I mean, their problem is who do they pick?
Yeah, right.
And I found it fascinating. I mean, you know, it was interesting because Mayor Bloomberg, who is, I think, 76, was here presenting grants to both the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul from part of his foundation. I mean,
right.
Obviously, this is one of the wealthiest people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing that all over the country. And one can't help but think, OK, he's running as a Democrat now. You've got Joe Biden, who's older. I mean, you sort of wonder what's going to happen.
Well, but also keep in mind the whole Sanders movement. I mean, I don't think they're going to embrace a billionaire
right.
necessarily. You have Kamala Harris, a senator from California, Cory Booker, a senator from New Jersey, both people of color. Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, a strong liberal, may run. So it's going to be a real Donnybrook, all sorts of people trying to run for president.
As if it hasn't been the past few years.
I know.
All right. Well, listen, Professor Stephen Scheer, thank you so much. So appreciate your time this evening. Great to talk to you.
I'll keep reading those emails.
I love them. They're fabulous. Okay. Professor Stephen Scheer, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time this evening. All right, folks. I want to give a huge shout out to Professor Scheer and all the other guests in this show. Want to give a special shout out to producer Jonathan Lowe. I didn't know until he left that it's his birthday tonight. So happy birthday, Jonathan. You're awesome. It's always great to work with you. I just really wanted to give you a thank you. And I would have given you a shout out earlier, but I didn't know it was your birthday. So, Anyway, thank you, Jonathan. Also want to thank Shaletta Brundage, who is also the studio producer here for this hour. And then also a big shout out to producer David Josephson, who is one of the producers for Dave Lee in the Morning. He does a fabulous job, so I really want to give him a shout out too. Please tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. Again, 10:30 a.m., back to the regular show with myself and Mike Augustinek. And Governor-elect Tim Walz will be live in studio at 10:30 WCCO-TV. WCCO, a quick break. We'll give you weather and more.